And good evening and welcome to another edition of Bird Calls from the No Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And we invite you to call in with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and with me tonight, Cliff Shackelford. He is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he's held since 1997, and he's also been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, which we proudly offered during our last pledge drive as a thank you gift, and he is also the author of more than 60 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas, and Cliff, welcome back to the show once again.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you.
So we heard just not too long ago on the news a very new story about bald eagles. And this is a relatively isolated incident, but apparently they've come down with some kind of mysterious illness. And where is this taking place at? Because you know a little bit more about it.
Well, first of all, that's one of the neat things about NPR. We get to hear about things before they really solidify, I guess you want to say, because those five dead bald eagles from Utah have been sent to the Wildlife Disease Lab in Madison, Wisconsin, and they haven't had a chance to look at them yet. So we don't really know the conclusion of the story. All we know is that it's five, maybe six bald eagles in Utah. And I think it's something for people to keep an eye out here in the Red River Radio listening area in case it happens here, too.
Yeah, hopefully this is not a pervasive situation.
So, right.
Now, right now, we're currently in the middle of the 114th annual Christmas Bird Count. Can you tell us, one, how did this get started? And two, what are you doing out there when you're counting these birds?
Well, this is an exciting time for the bird watchers because of the Christmas Bird Count season. And I just participated in the local Nacogdoches-Lufkin area Christmas bird count on Sunday and had a really good time. And the weather was fantastic. The birds were great, and it was really fun. And it started in 1900. A fellow by the name of Dr. Frank Chapman started it in New York as a sort of a response to what the traditional way of going out on Christmas Day was, to go out and just kill as many birds as you could. It was all about who shot the most birds. You didn't eat them. You didn't have really give a sporting chance to these birds. You shot game birds, non-game birds. And so he decided to come up with another alternative, was to go out and count the birds. And what's neat is we're still doing it. A century and more later, we're still doing it. And it's really grown, and there are counts all over the listening area, and the Shreveport count has already happened. It was December 14th, okay. But the Natchitoches count is coming up on December 21st. The Bossier-Caddo-Bienville count is happening on January 5th. So let me say that the Christmas bird count season is a three-week-long period, so these counts have to happen within that three-week window, and the idea is you spread them out so your bird watchers in the area can help on multiple counts. So you don't have them all on the same day, for example.
So if a listener right now listening wanted to get involved, how would they get involved
with
this?
Well, if you're in the Shreveport area, I talked to Dr. Charles Lyon. He's an MD here in Shreveport, and he compiles the Shreveport count that I said has already happened, but he also helps with the Natchitoches count. He's the compiler of that one. And that's December 21st, and what you want to do is call his practice in the Shreveport, here in Shreveport. He's an eye doctor, and you can look him up and give him a call and talk to him about how you can participate, because there are many levels of participation. You can be like the very beginner type that could go out with the experienced type and you'll learn a lot, or you can do it from your backyard and do what's called a feeder watch. So you would count everything that's coming to your backyard feeder, and you can stroll around your yard and see what else is coming in, or you could be one of those seasoned veterans that has an area that they religiously cover in the Christmas bird count circle, and they would cover that area and spend a 24-hour period. Of course, you don't have to do it 24 hours, but you want to get out early enough where you can count some owls and then all your daylight hours and see how many birds you can count. So it's a lot of fun. It's a little bit of a challenge for people. You know, you challenge yourself to get out there early, count as many birds, and not just species but individuals. And so that's what the tally is: you're looking to see how many species you've counted and how many individuals. And when the neat thing is, after like with the Nacogdoches count, we've been doing it for over 40 years. You can kind of see some trends. So what you're in the sense you're doing is taking a snapshot every year, and you're comparing those snapshots, and you can see things that are changing in numbers. So David and Mimi Wolf do a really fantastic job compiling our Nacogdoches count, and they have some data they've compiled, and it's pretty neat to see who's up and who's down.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can call in with your questions tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you have a photograph or a sound that you would like to send us and have Cliff try to identify that bird, then you can send that to rmoran@lsus.edu. That's rmoran@lsus.edu. And we do have our first caller online. This is Bubba from Tyler. Bubba, what's your question tonight?
Well, Bubba Bredis here, Mr. Shackelford.
Right.
You know, you're so dadgum good at answering so many questions about nature, flora, and fauna, birding, and stuff like that. I'm thinking maybe you're the guy that can answer a birding question that just seems to keep coming up.
Okay.
And that is, just what the heck is the difference between a red cock-headed woodpecker and a red-headed peckerwood?
Okay. Well, that's a good question. First of all, let me start by saying we have 8 species of woodpeckers in the listening area, and that includes the Tyler area. So the red cock-headed, though, has been extirpated from your area. You'd have to drive to the Maydell area to see the red cockaded in the ID Fairchild State Forest. That'd be your closest birds. So the way to tell all those apart, you know, that a lot of these woodpeckers have a couple things in common. They're black and white with some sort of.
You're listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can call in at 800-552-8502 with your question. You can go online and email rmoran@lsus.edu if you would like to send in a question that way. We have a quick kind of a yes or no question. Caller wanted to know if North Louisiana has roadrunners.
Okay, that's a great question, and the answer is yes. And actually, the whole listening area would have roadrunners. They're fairly evenly found throughout the year. I tend to see them more in the winter months. I don't know why that is, but they're really not migratory. They're just sort of moving into this area. I think probably 150 years ago, you might not have seen roadrunners here, but I think that since we've opened up the forest, they have moved from the west across to the east. So they are here. They're in small numbers. They're really neat neighbors to have. They like to eat snakes and lizards and other things. So they're good neighbors to have. They're really neat to watch, and yes, they are here.
Do they really go meep meep?
Yeah. No, and Wile E. Coyote, he exists too, but
is he as dumb as he seems?
Well, I don't know. We definitely have lots of Wile E. Coyotes, but very few roadrunners.
All right. We have another caller online and a couple of more. Please stay on the line. It takes a few minutes to get to you, but we're going to go to JP from Lufkin next. JP, what is your question tonight for Cliff?
Yes, good afternoon or good evening, Cliff. We are wondering if we can encourage you to make some owl sounds for us.
Oh, geez, on the air.
On the air.
Owl calls. Well, I could try to do that.
We are fans of yours.
Well, good. Well, good.
Our next question wants to know, do screech owls fly in unison? Can you do screech owls in unison?
I don't know about that either. And screech owl is a terrible name since they don't really screech. They make a whinny, and I'll do it here in a minute if I'm not too dry mouth. But thanks for the question here, and let's give it a shot. But before I do with the screech owl, I have to say one of my all-time favorite calls at Parks and Wildlife has been a lady that got jumped around, passed around at the department. She had a question. She didn't know what was calling outside her yard. It was somewhere in Central Texas. I don't recall where. It could have been anywhere in the state or even Louisiana, because she described it as a horse whinny or a little pony, actually. She said, I've got a something. I don't know if it's a bird or mammal or insect. It sounds like a pony up in the tree. And I can't have – no one can tell me what it is. What is it? And I said, oh, that's a great description. It's the horse whinny of an eastern screech owl. So let's do it. So that was me whistling. I hate to say it, I'm kind of whistling through some spit, and that gives me that trill, and that's what the screech owl sounds like. So if you have a little pony calling in your trees, that's the eastern screech owl. He's not very big. A full-grown screech owl is the size of a 12-ounce soda can. If you don't know how big that is, it's the same as a 12-ounce beer can. So the next one I'll do is the barred owl, and let me spell that. It's B-A-R-R-E-D, and it's named for the barring or the stripes all over the bird. And it's not to be confused with the barn owl, B-A-R-N. I'm not going to do that one. That's not a bird that's really common here. But this barred owl is very common here. And he sounds like he's saying, who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all? Here he goes. And when they're really excited, they make a lot of monkey call. To me, it sounds like a bunch of monkeys. So I call it the monkey call. And it's like this. So that's the barred owl, and that one is a lot of fun to imitate and to call in. And with our local Audubon Society, I was leading annual owl prowls, as they're called, and that was the one we go after, is the barred owl. So they don't swoop at you, they don't dive bomb you, they just come in when they hear what they perceive as an intruder, and that's a great way to see them. So you lure them in, you make the call in their territory, and it's kind of like saying, honey, I'm home, but the resident owl says, no, you're not, and they're coming in for a little battle, but they don't ever battle you, they just have a little bit of a shouting match. But you put a Q-beam on them, and it's a high-powered flashlight, and then the people can really see it, and it's a lot of fun. So that was barred owl, and the previous was screech owl, and I'll stop with those.
I need to bring my cricket sound effects in for if you're going to do those. So
yeah.
You're listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford. He's our resident ornithologist. You can call in tonight at 800-552-8502 with your questions, or you can email rmoran@lsus.edu. That's rmoran @lsus.edu. We have a quick online question. Do screech owls fly in unison? And also, are vultures edible?
Ooh, let's start with the vultures. I wouldn't go near a vulture dish. No, they're not edible. Well, you know, somebody's going to eat it, and probably another vulture, but edible for you and me? No. I'd stick to chicken, turkey, duck, quail. The ones that are traditional table fare, but no.
Not even with a good Louisiana hot sauce?
I don't think so. No, and Cajuns have mastered some other birds that aren't typically, they're really not game birds, like you'll hear about grosbec, and that's the night herons. Usually young ones are tasty. I've never eaten one, and it's actually not a game bird. You're not supposed to be collecting those. So those are going to be table fare from decades ago. But no, I'd stay away from the vultures. There's plenty of other things to eat. The first question was, do the screech owls fly in unison? I don't understand that question. If you mean like fighter jets, no. So if you've flushed two together, and I've done that off a roost, I flushed two birds in a clear cut one time. They were screech owls. They were sleeping in a really shrubby cedar tree, and they flew out together, but it wasn't in unison. It was just, oh my gosh, what is this guy doing here? That he found me. I'm trying to sleep. I'm going to fly away. So they flew away together. But no, they're not flying like fighter jets, coordinated and all. So.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford. And we have a full bank. Daryl, you're next. Mary, you're going to be after that. Bo and Larry, please stay on the line. And right now we go to Daryl from Jenna. Daryl, what's your question tonight for Cliff?
Yeah, Cliff, I just moved over here from Texas. I was living in Greenville, Texas. And we were having an influx of some birds of prey come in that I didn't recognize. They kind of looked like a hawk. They remind me of a jayhawk from Kansas, but they were a kind of a gray hawk with a banded tail and banded wings. And I was kind of wondering if you would happen to know what exactly kind of hawk that was.
And were you seeing that in Greenville or here or both?
Yeah, up in Greenville. They've come in the last year or so. There have been an influx of them, and there was like a colony of them living up there, up around the scrub oaks. We'd see them out on the roads. I haven't ever seen that type of hawk before, other than, like I say, in Kansas, they had some of those gray-colored hawks. But these had white banded tail and wingtips.
Yeah, well, I'm going to say that those were crested caracaras, because the first ones I ever saw were not far from there in the Terrell area, which was, 30 minutes or so, 45 minutes south of Greenville. And
yep.
And those, they're not really gray, so they're very brown, very milk chocolate brown. But I hadn't thought of that, but they kind of do have that jayhawk look. But you did describe well the tail and the wingtip. So the colloquial name for that is the Mexican eagle. You'll hear some people call it a Mexican eagle. It's not an eagle. It's actually more closely related to falcons, and it is called the crested caracara. And where you saw it, there are a couple pockets where they occur. But if you really want to see where they're widespread, South Texas is where they are. So like south of San Antonio all the way to Hidalgo County, that's where they're really thick.
All right, you are listening to Bird Calls tonight with Cliff Shackelford. He is our resident ornithologist, and you can call in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we're going to go next to Mary from Texarkana. Mary, what's your question tonight?
I have a question about barn owls, and you said they were pretty rare, and I have a passel. Is it a passel owls? Actually, several families that live around my house, and I was wondering what their territory is, because when I go about quarter of a mile or three quarters of a mile away to my dad's house to feed my horses, I hear the owls too, and I didn't know if it was two separate families or the same owls that I know are nesting in an old storage building at my place.
Uh-huh. Well, now, the barn owl is in this list. This listening area is pretty big and diverse, so I should have clarified that barn owl is going to be in the forested conditions. But once you go north of where I'm at and you get into more of the open area, like the previous caller was talking about Greenville, when you get up into that area and east of and that more prairie country, there are barn owls there. And I should say there are spotty records of barn owls in the piney woods of East Texas and Louisiana, and they are, you described it well, they're going to be using barns. Another thing they like to use are deer blinds, and hunters in South Texas have learned that you have to board up your deer blind in the off season, because if you leave the door open or the windows don't have glass or covering, the barn owls look at that as utopia, and they nest in there and they make a mess. They're cool to have. Let me make sure everybody realizes that owls are fantastic neighbors to have. They're eating a lot of the things that we consider pesky, rodents, for example. So the barn owl, your question was how big of an area? It's probably a matter of quality of the grassland. So in other words, if you've got a lot of forests in there, they're not going to forage in the forest. They've got to forage in open ag land or open pasture land. So it's probably a matter of quality. And I would probably guess that about 150 to 200 acres is going to be enough for a family group. But that, again, if you throw in some a pond, they're not going to use that. If you're going to throw in some woods or scrub, they're not going to use that. So it's not going to be contiguous sometimes. They might be flying over the woods to go to another pasture. So I'm not going to be able to answer that question of if that pair that you have is the same as when you go to your other the other property you mentioned. I don't know, because we'd have to mark the birds to know that answer.
You are listening to Bird Calls tonight with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to Bo next, but Larry, you're up after that. Bo from Fishville, you're on the line with Cliff. What's your question?
My question is, a nest in a Cape Jasmine bush in our yard about 2 feet off the ground, some kind of bird that I never saw built a nest. It was an orb. He wove the limbs together, and he mutated the leaves where the Cape Jasmine leaves are about 3.5 inches long. These little leaves were about an inch long all around his little orb, had a little hole in the middle for the nest.
Okay. Well, that's a common observation where when the leaves fall off of young saplings, all of a sudden we see that there was a nest there that we never realized in the breeding season. And that's because these birds are secretive and they don't really want it to be front and center, that nest. But all of a sudden we end up seeing it. One of those nests that I see a lot, and I talk to people that see a lot, that you described it fairly well, especially how high it is off the ground, is a little thicket-loving bird called the white-eyed vireo. And
repeat that for me.
It's white, as in black and white, eyed vireo, V-I-R-E-O. So I'm not looking at a picture of what you saw, and so it's very difficult for me to tell. Another one that people find a lot near the house is going to be a cardinal nest, but it's a much bigger nest with a lot of stick base to it and more of a soft cup nest in the middle. And then also, nests tend to change shape and form over the year or years, depending on how much water hits it, because it starts to rot and change shape. But the neat thing about the white-eyed vireo is it hangs from usually a little fork in the tree, and it looks like someone wove a little basket, like a little purse. And I see those a lot.
Feet off the ground.
They're usually pretty low, and it's usually because when they're nesting, it's real thickety, and they have a lot of cover, and it protects that nest so no one can find it. No one, I mean, by a predator.
And you are listening to Bird Calls tonight with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. And if you don't want to go on the air, you can just go ahead and give them your question. They'll pass it in through us. We have Larry from Shreveport next. Larry, what's your question tonight?
Yes, good evening. First-time listener and enjoying the show. I'm hoping that Mr. Shackelford might be a little bit up on his waterfowl. Quickly, I am a duck hunter for the last good 40 years. Most of that has been in Arkansas around the Stuttgart region, and also do some fishing down the coastline. The last couple of years, my brother and I have started to see some infiltration. No question, it was a black-bellied tree duck that we're seeing down in the coastline of Louisiana that we've seen down there. But this year in Arkansas, kind of at the opening of the regular duck season there, I know for sure that I saw six whistling ducks go by that I've never seen before in the 40 years I've been hunting in that region up there. And I know the fulvous tree ducks, the other types of tree ducks and around, but these were not pink legged and pink billed as the black belly is. My question really is, why are we now seeing these birds, most of which I know has been in Mexico,
right,
South Texas region, all the way to Arkansas now? And I thought I'd call and see what your theory on that is. The other thing I would tell you, for as far as my answer goes, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, we used to walk on the ice on the places that we were hunting there in Arkansas.
Yeah.
I haven't done that in 25 years.
Yeah, that's right. And a big complaint among duck hunters is that the ducks aren't down here in Texas, Louisiana, because why would you need to leave Missouri or points farther north if the water doesn't freeze solid and there's no food? So that there's a lot of grain spillage, there's open water, why go south? And that's one of the complaints. Now, let me address the whistling ducks, or the former name would be tree ducks, and I'm going to kind of pool them together collectively, but really, really stress the black-bellied, that I think one thing that's helping them is the increase or the interest by landowners to put up wood duck boxes. So those two whistling ducks also need a cavity, and that's what a wood duck box is. It's a cavity where they can put their eggs and nest in. So I think that the increase in wood duck boxes has helped wood ducks, but it's also encouraged whistling ducks to move inland, especially the black-bellied whistling duck. So most ducks don't use a cavity. There are only a handful in our area. The other one, the wood duck, the black-bellied whistling duck, and the hooded merganser are the dominant ones in our listing area. So you mentioned fulvis. They're really tough to find in the nesting season. You got to go down to the coast really to find them. And then if you go up north, the bufflehead and the golden eyes, some those birds are cavity nesters as well. But for the most part, the rest of the ducks as a whole, they're not cavity nesters. And most of those don't nest in the south. They nest up in the prairie pothole, for example, and they're nesting on the vegetation on the ground. So I think that's why we're seeing the increase in black-bellied whistling ducks. You could say that also climate change. I don't know, but I think that the wood duck box interest has really done it. And then to answer your question about the ice, it's true. You know, if you're not crashing through the ice, you're probably, you know, it's probably not any colder up north. And why would you leave points farther north? I mean, that migration is really an environmental thing, and if the environment is right, why keep going? So I think that's one thing that we that duck hunters have been complaining about. And you mentioned Stuttgart. I have to say that my favorite camo coat that I use for hunting and bird watching, I bought it at Max in Stuttgart. So I think everybody who's listening as a duck hunter has probably stopped into Max, because it's a very strange place. It's a big box store in the middle of nowhere. That's where I got my favorite coat. So Stuttgart, I know that place well.
Well, most of the hunting actually takes place in the middle of nowhere, too.
Yeah.
So that might be location, location, location. Give us a call tonight if you have a question for Cliff Shackelford. He is our resident ornithologist, and this show is called Bird Calls. The number to call, 800-552-8502. Again, 800-552-8502. Mark and Lynn, you are both on hold right now. We've got a couple of online questions, and we'll get to you in just a minute. Just please stay online with us. Bonnie from Huntington sent us in this question. Can screech owls sense the weather, and how do they do it?
Well, I you know, birds do probably sense the barometric pressure change. That's maybe one of the reasons that stimulates migration. But screech owls in particular, I don't think they have anything extra or different than the rest of the bird life, the bird community. So to answer that question, I don't think so. And really, screech owls are resident, so what would they need to know about the weather when they don't really leave that area?
Right.
So they don't have anything special. They don't need anything special. But birds in general, especially migratory birds, they probably can sense things that we have to use gadgets, like some device that checks the barometric pressure. That's probably built in with birds. There's a lot of neat things in birds that we do not fully understand, but we're pretty sure that it happens. I mean, think about, we have these GPS units. We have to plug them in, and it gives us a map. Well, birds have some sort of internal mapping system of their own, whether they're using the constellations or reference points on the ground. We don't really understand all that, but you know, you're packing all that, your barometric pressure gauge, your GPS, you know, bionic eyes that sees, I don't know, 10 times better than we do, all that into something that weighs about as much as a few coins in your pocket. So it's pretty amazing. So birds are remarkable. We haven't figured everything out. We haven't even figured everything out on our own species, but we are certainly trying to figure things out on birds because we can learn a lot from birds. I'll tell you, the military is super interested in how the hummingbird flight happens, how something can go forwards, backwards, up, down, all around. They are super interested in that for creating devices that can fly in that manner. So here's the military even looking and studying birds to benefit equipment that might be used for spying. So it's pretty neat, but we can learn a lot from birds.
You are listening to Bird Calls tonight on Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Lynn, you're up after Mark. Mark from Houghton, you are next. What's your question tonight for Cliff?
I hope you have time for two questions.
Okay.
First of all, we live about 3 miles south of Houghton, and every once in a while we have cats that disappear. And we also hear owls, and it sounds just like how I described the barred owl, the way it hoots.
Okay.
Now, we had a full-grown cat twice. It came to the house with a big tear down his back, and we had him sewed up twice. And then he just disappeared after that, and he was a full-grown cat.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that an owl is that big to pick one up off the yard and just take off with it?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't suggest the barred owl. He's very small-footed relative to how big the bird is. He's about the size of an NFL football, but they're pretty weak-footed, and what I mean by that is they don't really go after big prey, so they're not going to go after a cat. There is another owl that is much larger, much more powerful, and that's the great horned owl, and he sounds a little bit like this. Woo-hoo-hoo! 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 Woo-hoo! Very deep hoot. Sounds like he's saying, "Who's awake? Me too. Who's awake? Me too." So the great horned owl, but let me say, if you're putting your cats outside, they are vulnerable to many other things, namely your neighbor's dogs, your neighbor's cats, and coyotes. There are a lot of things that could slice that cat open like that. So the best thing to do for birds and lizards and other things is to keep your cats inside.
What kind of hawks might we have in the area that could also damage small house pets?
I think a red-tailed hawk would look at a cat as the size of prey that it would go after. The red-tailed hawk is kind of the daytime equivalent, the great horn, and they're looking for stuff that are skunk-sized, and that's what they're going after, or large rats, squirrels. Those kinds of things. So, I think that there are so many other things that kill cats. Cars kill cats. People with guns kill cats. If you love your cats, keep them inside. They will live longer and they will be happier for it.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can call us at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have a couple of online questions, but Lynn's been waiting for a little while. Lynn, we're going to come to you next from Marshall, Texas. What's your question tonight, Lynn?
Hi, thank you. I have two sounds that I've been very curious about. One I've been curious about since the 80s because I wrote a song using this bird's song as the intro. So anytime I'd like to give the bird credit, you know, when
sure.
I sing that song. And then the second one, I moved out in the woods in Harleton, and I didn't find him. I can't see him. It doesn't even sound like a bird. I swear to you, this bird says, "Oh, yeah." It sounds just like this. It goes, "Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah."
Hmm.
Is there a bird that makes that sound? Because I don't have any neighbors.
What time of the year are you hearing the "Oh, yeah"?
I moved in spring, and I haven't heard him since. I don't think I've heard him lately, but it's really a little better. I feel like I can't make it full voice because of the phone. I don't know if it'll come through. But I swear the bird goes, "Oh yeah." That's more like it.
Well, I would say that you're probably not hearing it right now because he's not here right now, except in very small numbers, and they're not vocalizing when they are here in the off season. But the gray catbird, he makes a meow sound that it fits your description. So he's going to be in the thickets. He's really, really hard to see, but he makes that sound. Usually we'll hear them in the spring and the summer. And yep. And I would look up gray catbird. He's related to the mockingbird. And he's all gray. And
he sounds huge. Is he huge or is his voice huge?
If you're going to use volume as a judge of size, it wouldn't work. Because look at our backyard Carolina wren. My goodness, that tiny little bird can pack a big punch with voice. So, no, usually that's usually a sign of a bird with a large territory that needs to be heard in all corners of that territory. So it would behoove you to have a loud voice if you've got a large territory.
He makes me laugh.
Yeah, so I'm betting that's gray catbird. And is that the same thing as your song ID? Is that
no,
okay, that's something else?
Thing, and I heard this, I'm trying to think what season. I don't necessarily pay attention. Maybe now I will. But here's the intro. Here's his song.
Okay.
And sometimes they sing it flat, too, which is hysterical to me. But it's
Oh, that's great. I know what it is already. I know what it is already.
What is it?
That's the white-throated sparrow that I mentioned earlier that's coming to feeders. And they.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess I tuned in afterwards.
No, we didn't. No, the good thing is we didn't talk about the song. So we're just bringing up the same bird again. It's a little deja vu. But no, I like that you brought it up because we didn't talk about the song. And what I think is really neat is it sounds like a human whistling.
Yes.
And it's
so
like,
cute.
Yeah. And you're like, is the neighbor over there whistling? And why does he keep whistling the same thing? Well, it's the white-throated sparrow. They start showing up in our area in October, usually later in October, and they stay till almost the 1st of May. I've seen some linger even longer, but even on the coldest days, they will sing, and it sounds like they're saying, "Oh, Sam Peabody, Peabody, Peabody."
And it doesn't sound like that to me.
Well, that's just the cadence, I guess. You whistled it pretty well. Yeah.
Sometimes it stings flat. Sometimes they go, you know, like they're tired or they've wound down.
Yeah, the hormones aren't really flowing. It could be first-year bird. He's not really figured out the right song, all the lyrics. cold days might be different. You know, you might be shivering when you're singing. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff going on. But bird song like that is typically a territorial thing and is typically used by the males to tell other males that, this is my territory, keep out. But they're not doing that in the winter as much because you'll see them in my yard. They're in groups of 30, 40. They're in big flocks, but they still sing. And it doesn't matter if it's a warm winter day or a cold winter day. And I'll tell you, I really like them. That my wife and I really love the white-throated sparrow, and I'm glad you brought up the voice because that's what we like most about them. So they scratch like chickens in the leaf litter. They're usually in the shrubs. They like cover. And so what we do in our backyard, we have what we call a wildscape. That's landscaping for wildlife. And when the stuff like the Turk's caps and the lantana die back, we leave it up, even though most people try to chop it off. But we leave most of it up if we can, or all of it up, because that cover is what they need. They need to forage underneath that for protection. They're in the leaf litter scratching, looking for grubs, other arthropods, seeds, whatever. But I do love the song, and I'm with you on that. It's one of my favorites, and I'm glad you wrote a song about it. Can you tell us about that? No? Okay. But anyway, white-throated sparrow, and that's a really fantastic bird. It's here in the winter.
So now, is that different? I took some photographs of some birds out on our roof for the building not too long ago, and that's a different species, or I guess subspecies of sparrows that I took?
It's a different species of sparrow, and it's actually in a different family. If people want to see what I'm looking at, it's on the Red River site.
Yeah, it's
right?
On redriverradio.org, and you click on the bird call post and open it up, scroll down, you'll see a big picture of some birds on the top of
right.
Our roof.
And you can see that they're sitting on the edge of a roof, blue sky background. These are all three house sparrows. So they're really weaver finches. They're not true sparrows. They're old world. They're non-native. They were brought over in the 1800s for several reasons. When people came over from the old world, they wanted to bring creature comforts, things that reminded them of home. So they brought a lot of the plants that they grew up with. They wanted to hear the birds that they grew up with. So they brought them with them. But also, you know, the house sparrow and the starling, some introductions were done to do some sort of insect control. So it didn't really work. Instead, the house sparrow has exploded. It's now, Atlantic coast to Pacific coast and south and north in the U.S. and Canada. It's unbelievable, really through the whole new world, but typically near humans. And that's why the name house sparrow is a great name. But this is very different from the white-throated sparrow taxonomically. And this is more, like I said, a weaver finch.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We have about 10 minutes left in our show tonight and quite a few questions. Carl, you're going to be up next. Mark, after that. But we have a write-in question before that. And this person wants to know, what is up with the male cardinal pecking at his window? Apparently, it's disturbing.
Yeah, that's a good question. I get that call a lot. Several birds that peck on windows. Number one culprit is the cardinal. When I lived in Austin, we got a lot of Central Texas callers asking about roadrunners doing the same thing. And actually, if you go out to your window and look right at the glass, get like that cardinal, get 4 inches, 3 inches away from the glass and look at the glass, not through the glass, what do you see? You see a mirror reflection of yourself. So that bird is not pecking at the glass because he wants to come in. He's not telling you to put some food out. He sees a mirror reflection of himself, and with that pea-sized brain, he hasn't figured out that it's not really an intruding male. So he's pecking at what he thinks is competition, and he's protecting his territory. So if it is a problem, and it is for some people that they don't like it, you can tape up some butcher paper, some newspaper. You just need to kill that reflection. You can put it on either side the glass and just put it up there for a little bit. It doesn't look too bad if you get just plain butcher paper. Just put it up for a few weeks and he'll move on, and maybe he might move to another window, but it's quite seasonal. They don't do it every day of the year.
Sounds like shadow boxing for birds.
Yeah.
So, all right, we are going to our next call. Carl from Crowley, you are on the line with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
How are you doing, Cliff?
Hey, pretty good. How are you?
Good. Speaking of the cavity ducks that you spoke of earlier, like wood ducks, we call them Mexican squealers.
Yes.
Down south. We've got some African squealers. I saw the first pair about 30 years ago. In April, when the farms around our area are planted in rice, there's thousands of them at night. You very seldom ever see them during the day. But at night, there's thousands of them, and that particular bird looks the same. It's a lot darker, maybe a little smaller, and it's got thick white patches on the wings. The bills are pink and the feet are pink.
Okay.
Whereas Mexican squealer is gray feet and gray bill and just a dark wing. And
okay.
I was just calling to see, is that particular bird from Africa, or why are there so many more that's starting to end up down south?
Yeah, they're not from Africa. There is a goose that's getting loose. Does that rhyme? I think it does. I didn't intend that, no pun intended. But the Egyptian goose is a cage bird that's getting loose, and people are seeing, but they're just in twosies, threesies. If you're, let's back up and talk about your names. I think the squealer, just the squealer period, is a good hunter name for the wood duck. But I think maybe we're getting some of the names mixed up, because the one you mentioned that has the pink, some people think red. Either way, pink or red legs and bill, that is the black-bellied whistling duck. And that's coming from Latin America. That bird is native to some Mexico, so that's where he's coming from. So nobody's flying over the big water like the Atlantic to get here. So none of those are from Africa. The one, the Egyptian goose I mentioned is from Africa, but they're getting loose from the waterfowl fanciers.
I am familiar with that goose, but this is a duck. And the Mexican squealers that we had forever are the brown ones with the gray feet and bill. Yeah. I thought those were from Mexico.
No, those are the fulvous whistling ducks, and they have been here probably for millennia. They are in the coastal prairie mostly, but they will go up north of that into the piney woods, and they get in the big flocks like you mentioned at night, and that's the fulvous whistling duck. So I've never heard that one called Mexican squealer.
I'll be though.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Okay. Kid. Hey, thanks, Carl.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have time for a couple of more calls. Mark from Houghton, you are online right now with Cliff. What's your question?
Sir, I hope this one doesn't sound silly, but I've had an interest in dodo birds and the history of them. I know they went extinct. I heard it was because of hunting. But where did they live? When did they go extinct? And did they really get all killed off by hunters?
Well, let's say they weren't really hunters. They were filling their bellies. They were sailors, and gosh, I think it was the island of Mauritius, and I think it went extinct in the 1500s. And I wish I had Google to check that. You could Google that and find the answers to that. But they've been gone for centuries. We don't have any. Specimens where we know what the color of them, what they were. So we've got plenty of skeletal specimens, but no feathers. So you'll see weird artist rendition. But they were actually a ground-dwelling and flightless columbid, meaning pigeon. So that's what they were related to. They're a big pigeon on the ground, and they didn't have any predators. That was typical of a lot of island endemics. That means a bird that doesn't occur or a species that doesn't occur anywhere else. And on an island, when they didn't have predators, they really didn't need to fly because there was nothing to flee from. But all of a sudden, sailors showed up. And if it's a pigeon relative and he's huge, he's bigger than a chicken or maybe the side chicken, he tasted very good. So they boxed him up and ate him up, and they didn't have to work hard to collect him. You could run up to him with a club and kill him. So I think it was island of Mauritius. That's with an M. So just Google that, and I think it was 1500s, long time ago.
We have one more call online. Cole from Lufkin, you are online with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist tonight. And what is your question?
Well, I live in the city limits of Lufkin. I live in town. This summer I've noticed that I've seen some birds I've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
I took some pictures of them and tried to research them, and the best I can tell that they're Mississippi kites.
Okay.
But I think I may be wrong about what they are, but they may have had their young in the yard.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really interested in them to know what I could find out about them, if they're gone right now.
Yes.
And so are all my squirrels.
Yeah. Well, that Mississippi kite's not going to eat squirrels. They are typically eating large insects. And they do breed in small little pockets here and there in the listening area. Very small numbers, and I'm glad you did. Sounds like you did your research and you did well, because he's a very unique bird. He's all dark slaty gray, and they nest in typically in tall trees, and they like cicadas, what some people might call locusts, those things that make loud noises in the summertime. They're really cicadas. They'll eat large grasshoppers, dragonflies, things that are flying around above the tree canopy, and you'll see the Mississippi kite swooping down and catching those large insects on the wing. So they vacate our area in October. And by November, they're pretty much all gone. And those birds that bred in your yard are probably somewhere in South America, which is amazing. They do it without getting on a plane, train, or automobile, and they will come back in the spring. So look forward to them in the spring, and that's a great bird, Mississippi kite. It's a raptor.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Cliff, we have about a minute left, and we have one question, and that is the Ethiopian vulture affecting the native turkey vulture?
Well, I think that the question is probably the species not correct. I think we're talking about the black vulture. There is no Ethiopian vulture in the U.S., so there is the turkey vulture and the black vulture. We have two species of vulture here in the listening area. They're both dark. The turkey vulture, as an adult, has a red head, and the gray-headed one is the black vulture. So I think the question is a good one, but I think that they're both occurring here together and pretty harmoniously. I'll see them at the same roadkill or dead cow at the same time, but the black vulture is much more aggressive and doing quite well, and their numbers are increasing. So look for the differences in the turkey vulture and the black vulture.
And very quickly, our final question online, are red-headed pileated woodpeckers an endangered species?
The pileated woodpecker and the red-headed woodpecker, those are two different species, and neither of them are endangered species. But let me make a point, they are protected species. So you don't have to be endangered to be protected. They're protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So if they're bugging you or pecking on your house, the solution is not to shoot them. There are other means of controlling problems, but they are protected even though they're not endangered.
You've been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and a statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everybody who called in tonight and the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for allowing us to use Cliff tonight. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. The producer for this show is myself, Bill Beckett, with help from Wally Derleth, Renee Moran, Daniel Gordy, and the audio engineer for tonight's program is yours truly. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll tune in for the next edition of Bird Calls here on Red River Radio, your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS.